Hey everybody, and happy Thanksgiving week. Although this won't come out the week of Thanksgiving. Anyways, welcome back to Pocket Theology, and thanks for joining us today. We're going to be talking about evangelism and discipleship, which are two big words that we use in the church a lot that everyone seems to have different ideas about. This is probably going to be a series, but we just want to give you a little bit of an introduction today. Martin, you're here with me. You want to say hi to everyone?
Howdy ho, neighbors.
You've used that one before.
I'm so sorry.
You should be.
Would you like me to find another one?
Yes, I want you to find another one.
Guten Morgen.
Nice. I think you actually used that too.
Nope.
Because I made fun of you for being the guy who wants to show off that he knows German. That's okay. You have volunteered to talk to us about evangelism. So let's start with a really easy question. What the heck is evangelism?
So the most basic definition for evangelism is sharing your faith with the people around you with the goal of helping somebody else to meet Jesus. And that's kind of the important part. There's a difference between admitting you're a Christian and evangelizing, but the most basic definition for evangelism is sharing your faith with somebody with the goal of helping them to follow Jesus.
So if evangelism is sharing our faith with someone, hoping to encourage them to follow Jesus, I actually want to ask a follow-up question before we get to our second like planned one. Is this something that like one individual always does? Is it, you know, like as a Christian, I'm walking around. Is it just my job to just go find random people and be like, do you know our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, like Jehovah Witness style? Is that what we're talking about? Is that always what it looks like? Or
I was actually going to get into that in the fourth question.
Ooh, but okay.
Basically, the short answer with a nod to future question is no, that is not an effective way to do evangelism, and for the most part, people will mace you if you walk up to their doors and start sharing about Jesus. And so it's super awkward. Nobody wants to be a part of it. And really, it's a power play, really. You're coming up to them to ask things like this, you know, do you know who Jesus is? Do you know what's going to happen when you die? You know, the big questions. And you're coming up to somebody with absolutely no preparation for this and saying, well, this is what I think. And that's what door knocking is. That's what Jason's mm-hmm. referring to is door knocking.
Yeah.
It never works. I shouldn't say never. Never is a strong word. It fairly rarely works. I, in my personal life, have never seen this happen effectively. And part of what I'm going to mention in the future is that evangelism isn't something that you just do for everybody, if that makes sense. There's motives behind it. And part of what you need to do to have effective evangelism is a relationship with the person that you're talking to.
Yeah, there's so many things that you could tag on to that door knocking conversation. Maybe we'll come back to that in the future. But Martin, I'm sure you've had other like near Christian groups door knock at your places before, right?
Yep. I actually recently had a group about Christian parenting came by, and they knocked on my door when my sister-in-law was here. And I went and answered the door, and they said, well, do you know Jesus? And I said, I am a pastor, so I hope so. And they kind of go, oh, okay. And then shared their little thing, which immediately went in the trash for me. They were kind of trying to get this, well, if you're a good Christian parent, we should have Christianity in the schools. We should be praying in the schools. We should be doing A, B, and C. And for those of you that don't know me, I am not about that. I don't think that that's freedom of religion.
Yeah, and, like as an organized required thing. Like you would hope that your like kids in your youth group would want to like pray during their school day, but that's like an individual decision.
Yeah.
they shouldn't have teachers forcing them to or something.
They're also looking for very Pharisaical prayer, you know, very much, well, let me stand at the streets and pray as loud as I can with my hands held high.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so for the most part, that's not what your prayer life should be, first of all. But second of all, that's not freedom of religion. That's exactly what Jesus condemned in the New Testament.
Yeah, I love the response when someone comes up to your door, because whether they're actually Christian or they're like near Christian, like Mormon or Jehovah's Witness or whatever, they always start with like, do you know Jesus, or do you know about the Bible? Do you read the Bible, or some sort of question like that? And I love the power play of being able to be like, I'm a pastor, so yeah. That's always how I respond. I'm like, I'm actually a pastor. Thank you so much for asking. And then I invite them in. And I'm like, hey, you want to sit down and have some coffee with me? And they always get really excited about it until we actually start talking. And then they realize, oh, he actually is a pastor and he knows more than I do. And then they get intimidated. And in one case, I had some World Mission Society door knockers that left and then came back with their youth pastor the next day. Because they're like, oh, God, we're not smarter than him. Bring the youth pastor. He'll get him. So that was fun. Anyways, evangelism. Door knocking is a bad idea. We got that much. Pastors will have a lot of fun with you if you try door knocking and show up at their house. Why does evangelism matter, though? Assuming we're doing it the right way, and we'll get into like what the right way is in a minute. Why does it matter? Why should I care about evangelizing if I'm just your normal standard Christian? Show up on Sundays, do my small group, do my volunteer hours. Why should I add evangelism to that pile?
So for those of you that don't know the story of the Samaritan woman at the well, it's one of my favorites, and part of it is because of the evangelism aspect that takes place at the end. And so, spoiler alert, it's super related to what we're talking about. But the way it starts out is Jesus and his disciples go to this well, and then the disciples leave to go get food. And Jesus is just kind of hanging out. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and all of the people in town, for the most part, have already gotten their water. They come out to the well. They pick up their vase. They take it back. And this Samaritan woman comes out, and they have a conversation. And there's a lot of cultural barriers that are being broken through this. There's a lot of religious barriers that are being broken through this. Most of you guys that have heard this, you probably know, Samaritans were treated like dogs to the Jews. And that's kind of the short way to describe how they're treated. But more than that, even, women weren't treated well. It would be super taboo for Jesus to be talking to this woman by herself because he's a dude. And so it looks really bad on everybody.
Yeah. People in those tiny communities assume things, which sounds a lot like today.
She starts out seeing this guy as just some Jewish dude. And through the conversation that ensues, she goes from a Jew to a prophet to the Messiah. And when she finally,
the way that she perceives of Jesus, that she's looking, yes, at Jesus and saying, oh, you're just a Jewish dude. And then she goes, oh, you must be a prophet. And then she goes, oh, God, you're actually the Messiah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so as this whole thing is taking place, she's gaining a relationship with Jesus, which is, first of all, it's insane how fast that happens in the story. It looks like it's like 2 minutes, but because of the things that he does, she understands that he is the Messiah, and she decides, after building this relationship with Jesus, that the next thing that she needs to do is she needs to run into town because she's so excited and share it with everybody who will listen. And then she brings a crowd of people out to see him. It's this cool story about how Jesus, first of all, cares about the people that no one else really does. He cares about orphans, widows, the weird kid in high school, all of them, right? But on top of that, it's this story about how when you truly meet Jesus, when you truly interact with him, there's some sort of excitement or fire that gets started in that moment. And that has to be shared with people. Jesus did not, when he resurrects and talks to his disciples, did not say, well, stay, therefore, and make sandwiches. He He said, go therefore and make disciples. It's not about keeping your faith for yourself. It's about sharing it with the people around you. And between the story of the Samaritan woman and how excited she is and the direct command from Jesus to go and do this, I'd say that it's pretty important to what we do. Jesus has never wanted us to sit in our church service on Sunday morning and say, well, I'm good. And even if your life changes from that and you start to live a life that looks more like Jesus, that helps your evangelism. That's going to benefit what you're doing. It matters because if we truly care about the people around us, we want them to be with us in eternity.
Yeah, and that last line is really important, right? Like, we are talking about the difference between someone spending an eternity with us, with the church, and most importantly, with God, or not. And yeah, you can't force someone to follow Jesus. The church has tried that in the past. It doesn't work, but you can encourage that behavior. There are things that you can do to make that more likely. And if you don't, there will likely be, if we don't, like as a community, there will be many people that could have spent forever with God that will not. A really interesting stat I was looking at for my sermon this upcoming Sunday, which will be the past Sunday when this episode comes out. Pew Research did a survey or a study about people coming to Christian faith, leaving Christian faith, and they included near Christian groups like World Mission Society and Mormons and whatever. And they had right now 64% of the United States population identifies as Christian. Now, these aren't people that are actually committed and going to church and whatever, but they identify themselves as Christian or as part of a near Christian group. Now, 50 years ago, that was 90%. So just shy of a third of the U.S. population has left a Christian faith within the last 50 years. And then they did projections. From the year 2020 onwards, if no one converts to Christianity, but no one deconverts either, which obviously is not going to happen, then 54%, just with population changes, 54% of the U.S. will be Christian in 50 years. That's 10% drop just from people having babies and moving into the country and moving out of the country. If the current rates stay the same, it'll be 46%. So almost 20% of the population will go from being Christian to not being Christian. If things get worse, it could be as much as a third of the U.S. population will be Christian, meaning that we lose a third of the U.S. population in 50 years. So we're talking about millions and millions of people just in the U.S., not even talking about other countries, that are going to walk away from Jesus if things don't change. That's really, really significant. And that's a reason why we should care about telling others about our faith, because we don't, if Christians aren't telling them, who else will? Now, Martin, you kind of answered the third question, which is where do we see it in the Bible? You talked about this Samaritan woman. She has this conversation with Jesus. Jesus, being Jesus, sees this opportunity for someone that he does not know and who clearly does not know him and is able to evangelize. We call that cold evangelism. We say it's usually a bad idea, but Jesus pulls it off. And then she goes to people she knows and tells a bunch of people that she probably grew up around that have probably known her for a very long time, all the good and all the bad. And there's a lot of bad with her, if you read this story. And she goes and tells them about Jesus. So that's more what we would say is normally a good idea, telling people that you know and have a relationship with. So we see that in the Bible. There's other examples. Are there any other examples that you wanted to point out? Or do we think that's a good place?
There's the quote in Romans where Paul says, if you don't preach, how are they going to hear? Right. And that's another kind of command to go and do this. Yeah. Jesus and Nicodemus in John chapter 3, which is where John 3:16 comes from. Jesus preaches to Nicodemus. He teaches Nicodemus that God truly does love the entire world and not just Israel. And because of that, he's going to give his son and have him sacrificed for the sins of the people. And then Nicodemus is like, yo, that's freaking hype. Let me follow that dude. those are the ones that really stick out to me. Peter and Cornelius in Acts chapter 10.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman dude.
Yeah.
And really just the entire book of Acts. Anytime that Paul goes to a new city, that's cold evangelism for the most part, but he's church planting, and so That's a
Well, he's frequently going into contexts that are more used to that sort of stuff. So he's going into marketplaces and telling people about this new religion. But you would expect that if you go to the marketplace, you'd have like a stoic on that corner and a priest from the local temple on this corner. And everyone's talking about philosophy and religion. It's just kind of what they did. So like his famous Mars Hill sermon, he literally goes to a place where people gather to discuss philosophy. And he says, I have a new philosophy for you guys. I want to talk to you about. So like, he's not going somewhere where people don't want to be talked to about religion. He's going to places where they expect to hear about religion and is basically debating people. So it's a little different than door knocking because he's not invading people's homes and trying to like con them into following a new religion. He's going where they expect it and then trying to prove his case.
He does do that in the synagogue though. Which is
he does. He goes into the synagogue, but also you have to understand, like, he's going into the synagogue and he's trying to say, like, there's been a fulfillment to the religion you already follow. So to Paul, like, Christianity and Judaism aren't different things. Christianity is the fulfillment of Judaism. And so he feels like he's going to Jews, and you can see this reflected in his writings. He's going to Jews and just telling them about how to be more Jewish than they already are by following Jesus. So still think it's, the context is a little bit different, but yeah, it's semi-cold. It's lukewarm evangelism, I guess. Is there anything else before we move on to discipleship that you want to add on here? Anything that'll help people get how important this is or how to do it? We said a little bit about door knocking isn't effective. Do you want to say anything about what are good ways to evangelize? And we can dive into that in later episodes in more detail, but just any parting thoughts you want before we move on?
Yeah. So a lot of the way that I learned how to do evangelism as a kid and the way that I've learned to do evangelism as an adult are very different. And so as a kid, my evangelism was, hey, why don't you come to church with me on Sunday and we can talk about Jesus? And, you know, that's great. But Paul said, when I was a kid, I talked like a kid. I thought like a kid. But when I became mature, I had to grow up, right? He had to develop a more mature faith. He had to do A, B, and C. And the same thing happens with our evangelism. The truth is, and I think Jason will back me on this, if your idea of evangelism is bringing somebody to the church as an adult so that the preacher can preach at them, they're not going to get to meet Jesus. The preacher is, you know, that they're great. Jason's a preacher and I like him despite it. but it's a cool way to get people involved in the church, but it is not always the best way to see Jesus working in people's lives. There's a really good book that I read recently that has really shaped the way that I do evangelism as an adult. It's called Talk the Walk, and it's written by a guy named Steve Brown. He teaches at Reformed Theological Seminary, but he is really understanding what it means to communicate Jesus to people, and he talks a lot about positions that you should be in before you do. He talks a lot about things that you need to know before you do, and there was one part that really stuck out to me. He talks about specific times when you should not share your faith, which is really important because the way that a lot of us talk about evangelism is, well, just do it. It doesn't matter what you know or who you're talking to, just do it, right? But there are definitely situations that you should not be preaching Jesus to people, which if you think I'm a heretic, you can throw the book at him instead of me. But and one of the ones that really got me was when I was reading, and he says, if you do not fully know the gospel, do not try to share it. If you don't have a grasp on what the gospel is and what it does for not just you, but for the entire world around you, then don't be sharing it with people, because you're going to do it poorly, first of all. Second of all, they're going to chew you up and spit you out almost immediately. And so I think that's really important. he's saying as you grow to know Jesus better, you can start doing this. But if you have a very shallow faith, if you have almost no knowledge about who Jesus is, and really all you know is the dude was God and that he died and came back from the dead, and now you can get your getting into heaven free card, then you shouldn't be sharing that faith with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few, and like I said, in a later episode, we should get more into detail about this, but there's a few things that makes me think of. One, first one, our contexts are really different culturally. So we both serve in the Midwest, but Martin, for those of you who don't know, Martin is serving in a college city in Ames, Iowa, where Iowa State's at. I am serving in a rural historic coal mining community that is currently all the coal mines are shut down except one. And so it's a farming town now. So it's a lot poorer. It's a lot more conservative than the community that Martin serves in. It's also above national average in number of people identifying as Christian. Our community is something like 70 or 75% self-identified Christians. But in that community, only about maybe 15% of the town actually attends church. So most of the people, if I go and I just meet some random person at Walmart that does not attend church right now, the odds are that person would call themselves a Christian, but just has like no standard markers of discipleship. They don't go to church. They don't serve. They don't pray very often. They don't read their Bibles, but they would call themselves Christian and have some awareness of the faith. So the way I talk to that person about Jesus is different than talking to someone who is raised like as an Orthodox Jew or as raised in an atheistic or agnostic household. Like those are two different, because they have different amounts of knowledge. So the way that I would put it is this way. When you're deciding whether or not, like assuming that you like know enough to actually talk to someone about Jesus and you actually have a strong enough relationship and a strong enough knowledge of Jesus, when you're talking to someone and trying to convince them following Jesus is what you should do, you should become a Christian, you should approach it kind of like if you were convincing a family member to go to the gym to like work out regularly. You have to ask the question, first of all, do they even realize this is important for their health? And then if the answer is yes, then you need to convince them, well, this is why this is the best way to go about this issue. So someone, if you're trying to convince a family member, hey, you should start going to the gym, you should start working out. If they don't even believe that exercise is good for them, you need to start there and convince them that exercise is good for them. And then you need to convince them why they should go to this particular gym that you were recommending. If they agree that exercise is important, they just don't do it, then the conversation's different. You're talking about, hey, how do you make time for this sort of thing? And if they agreed it's important, they have time for it, and they're just looking for a gym, then all you need to do is say, hey, this is why my gym is really good. Same thing, same kind of thing when you're talking to people about Jesus. If someone doesn't even believe in Jesus, you need to start at square one. You need to convince them, no, Jesus, look, Jesus was an actual person and he was actually God. If they believe in Jesus, believe that he was real, believe that he was actually God, but they just aren't sure about organized religion, they need to talk to them about why organized religion, organized Christianity is not a bad thing. But if they buy into all that, they've just been out of church for a while, but they're looking for a church, then all you need to do is say, hey, I know this great church. You're looking for one. I think you can come and get plugged in. Like those are all very different conversations depending on where that person's at. So approach evangelism in that kind of way. Ask, where's this person at? What do they need to know? You know, what kind of conversation do I need to have with them? And make sure you actually have the rapport to have that conversation with them. Because if I just meet someone in Walmart and they're on one of those rascals, little motorized scooters, and they're like really overweight, and I walk up and I say, you look like you need a gym. That's really freaking insulting, isn't it? But we approach evangelism that way. We're just like, wow, you seem like a heathen. You need Jesus. Like, no, you need to have a relationship with someone that's strong enough to tell them, hey, this might hurt to hear, but you need XYZ. You know, you need exercise. I'm going to talk to you about it because I love you and I'm your best friend. Or, hey, you need Jesus and I love you and I'm your brother or your mom or your son or whatever. And I'm going to tell you about this because we have a strong enough relationship to have really hard conversations. So those are my add-ons. Like I said, we need to get more into detail about that in a later episode. But right now, I think I'm happy leaving it there. Any last minute thoughts, Martin?
You have to... This is my last thing. You have to define what a win is as well. because winning evangelism, it sounds terrible to say, but winning at evangelism is important. And when you talk, you know, if you ask me what my definition of a win is, my definition of a win is not having somebody go to my church and show up on a Sunday. My definition of a win is having somebody who decides to move into their faith and who decides that they are going to find a body of believers to connect with.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't have to be my church. I am very open about that. It doesn't have to
be your tradition.
Exactly.
Like, we're Protestants, and if somebody decided, because Martin had a conversation with me, I'm going to go be Orthodox now. We may not agree with all the theology, but we'd be like, hey, that's a heck of a lot better than what you were doing.
Exactly. And so, for me, a win is not having someone show up to my church, and it is not getting somebody dipped. That's kind of where I fall on it. A win for me is getting somebody connected to a body where they can continue growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Am I moving? I'd be even laxer in what I consider to be a win. Something about like some people around our age that I've had conversations with that are definitely not Christian and are even like anti-church, or like they don't trust pastors or something. For me, often a win is just having conversations with those people about my faith, and usually not very intellectual, just like, this is my experiences, this is what I try to do, and this is what I see in the church, and this is what I see in the Bible. And then walking away and saying things like, you know, you're the only pastor I've ever met that I feel like I can really talk to, or something like that, because I know that I'm changing their perception. They have negative perceptions about Christians, and I'm giving them a positive perception of at least one or two Christians, at least like me or me and my wife. And that's a win, because they're closer to Jesus than they were. It's a small win, but it's still a win. So I'd say anything that moves people closer to Jesus and closer to his people is a win. And you should look at it that way. What is it that Paul writes to the Corinthians? That I sowed, Apollos watered, but God reaps the harvest?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, that's the way that we need to view evangelism. Like, your job might be to sow the seed, and then someone else might water it, and then someone else might help it to grow, and then someone else might actually harvest it. Like, and all of it is ultimately controlled by God, and it's not in your hands. So just try to do something that helps.
Well, on that note, I say we shift towards discipleship. Discipleship. Listen, it was a long night.
Thanksgiving really got you, huh, buddy?
It really did. But we're going to move towards discipleship now. So I spoke a lot about evangelism, and Jason said he would be the brave person to try and talk a little bit about discipleship and what it is. So Jason, mm-hmm. How would you define discipleship?
Yeah. Like the Bible intends it to be defined, hopefully. So two different ideas of discipleship that you should picture in your head when you hear the word. One is you have like the Jewish concept of a disciple, like someone who follows after a rabbi, who emulates the rabbi and learns from the rabbis. You have this, a rabbi is a religious teacher, and they would have a number of basically like apprentices. And those apprentices would live with them, travel with them, learn from them constantly, with the goal of eventually becoming rabbis themselves. So that's the kind of picture you should have. I'm closely following after someone who's teaching me the way of faith with the goal of eventually being like them. So as Paul puts it, follow me as I follow Christ, right? Now the Greek word itself, mathetes, is a word that refers to apprentices. So if I was like a blacksmith, you know, then I would have people living with me that would often be relatives of mine, but not always, that I would be teaching how to be blacksmiths. And they'd be younger men. So these kids, they're going to live with me, they're going to work with me, and I'm going to supervise and teach them in the ways of my craft. Again, very similar to the people who follow after the rabbi. They're being taught the skills needed. But the thing is, in this case, you're not learning to be a carpenter or to be a blacksmith or to be a plumber or whatever. You're being taught to be a Christian. So discipleship is when I have a older in the faith, not necessarily older in physical years, but someone who is older and wiser in the faith who is teaching me to become more like Jesus by emulating them. So if I'm thinking about people who have discipled me or are currently discipling me, then I'm thinking about people like Dr. Jim Estep, Dr. Gary Johnson, Dr. Jason Posnick. Those are all individuals who have discipled me recently. Further back in my past, like when I was a teenager, my youth pastor, Corbin Crocker, who is not a recognizable person. He was a youth pastor in Blacksburg, Virginia. He definitely discipled me. His little brother was a peer of mine, but he was a few years ahead of me and knew Jesus better than me. His name's Tyler. He definitely discipled me. So these are all people that at the time, they were further ahead in their knowledge of Jesus and in their devotion to Jesus, further ahead of where I was. And they basically just said, come with me. Let me show you how to do this Jesus thing. Now, I'm not one of the people that thinks that you have to be discipled by someone that's the same gender as you. I do not think that is the case, but I do think that's normally how things are going to work out. At least in my experience, you'll notice all the people I named are males. In my experience, there's something, and I think this is borne out in Genesis. There's something unique, and to steal a term that's used for a different theological position, there's something unique and complementary about the genders. There's a reason why women are made as an ezer, as reinforcements to the male, because each one is insufficient on their own to complete God's mission. You need both. So it would make sense that other people that fill the exact same role in fulfilling God's mission as you would be the people to disciple you. But it doesn't always have to be that way, because there's definitely women that I look up to in the faith that have taught me things, such as Dr. Sherry Bradley, right?
Just so, got her PhD. Shout out to Sherry.
Shout out to Sherry, yeah. So there's definitely people that I have learned from. The only reason why I wouldn't put them on that list is because I wasn't necessarily close enough to them to say they discipled me, but they have contributed to my faith journey. So that is, in a sense, a type of discipling. Just not as close as what I was talking about previously. But anyways, so yeah, it's finding someone who I think will often be the same gender as you, but not always, that is older in the faith, that will teach you to copy the things they do to be like Jesus.
That's a really good definition. I have a few things to add on the gender thing. First of all, I don't think it's, I agree with Jason. I don't think it's required that it be somebody of the same gender, but I also know what it looks like to the world around you. And so you have to be really careful with some of those things. Especially as a leader in a church, it is very easy to let people keep an interpretation that is not necessarily accurate. And so,
which there's doesn't a lot mean of, you don't disciple people who are the opposite gender. It just means you need to be aware of what that might look like to others and take that into consideration. So even if it's as simple as like when a lady, if you're a dude and you're a leader in the church and a lady comes into your office to talk to you about whatever, then maybe you say, hey, let's move this out into the coffee area, and you sit in front of, you know, the camera in the coffee area, just so if any accusations were to happen, you just be like, there's a freaking recording of it, like, go look at the recording, nothing happened, you know. Anyway, continue, Martin.
Yeah, and so I think that's important. I also think that it is easier to talk about certain things that you might be struggling with somebody of the same gender. So teenage boys often struggle with pornography, and they don't really want to bring that up with a woman. Part of that is because the way that porn rewires your brain to objectify women, and so you don't see them as an equal. You you might see them as an object. So why should I have to talk with them about this? The other part is, you know, some things, there are some things that are inherently gender-based that you might fall into. And so, just as a general factoid, this doesn't have to be proven or anything, men struggle with pride a lot. And so, it's easier to relate with somebody who also struggles with that. Women struggle a lot with being hurt by people, especially teenage girls. I remember there were a couple of teenage girls in our youth group that, I mean, they were in relationships every other week, and they were just destroyed when their boyfriends broke up with them. And Jason's shaking his head because he knows, you know, he knows the feeling. He's been destroyed like that. But
multiple times. But I'm married now and my wife seems to like me, so I'm good.
But it's something that is easier to bring up with somebody who kind of understands. And so I don't know that pain because, you know, my wife was my first girlfriend. So
Martin started dating Maddie and just went, it's never getting any better than this. He knows when he's batting out of his league, man.
My biggest flex is that I only had one girlfriend, and it's my wife.
So I would have made fun of you for that when I was like 18, but now that I'm in my mid-20s, I'm kind of envious of that, but that's an episode for a different time.
Yeah. Okay. So, Jason, tell us a little bit about why discipleship matters.
All right, so let's go back to that, how mathe taste is used in Greek society. So imagine that you are the disciple, you are the mathe taste that is learning from blacksmith how to make horseshoes. So if you're discipled well, you'll make good horseshoes, and you will successfully place them on horses, and the horses will be happy and healthy, and your customers will be happy, and you will get money, and things will be good, and you will make a living. Now imagine that you were never discipled. You just start calling yourself a blacksmith one day, and you're like, whatever, can't be that hard. You're going to have some troubles. You're going to hurt some horses. You're going to waste some material. You're going to have some ticked off people that are suing you. Like, you're going to cause much more harm than good for yourself, for those close to you, for the community that you live in. The same is very much true of Christians. When you come to know Jesus, if you are discipled, then you will learn to skillfully live as a Christian, to share your faith with others, to talk well about it, to be a boon to the community around you in the name of Jesus. If you are never discipled, you are dangerous. You are dangerous to your church. You are dangerous to your family. You are dangerous to the community outside of your church. Every single one of us has like church Karens on Facebook or Instagram or whatever. They're always posting things like, if you are a homosexual, you will burn in hell. God does not love you. And like, you're just kind of looking at that and you're like, I get where they're coming from. Like, I get why they think that that's a thing that's okay to say, but it's definitely not. And the reason is that person was never discipled. That person has a vague knowledge of Jesus, and they were never taught how to live well as a Christian. And so they are hurting the perception of others, like others' perception of the church. They're hurting others' perception of them. And anyone who is close to them is going to be guilty by association. So this is when you end up like as a pastor. When, now luckily I'm blessed at this point to serve in a church where we don't really have anyone like that, but we will eventually, if we continue to grow, those people will show up. When I've served in the past at churches that have those kinds of people, and I run into someone in the community and they ask me what I do, and I say, oh, well, you know, I'm a student, but I preach on Sundays at this church. Then that's when you get the, oh, I know someone who goes there. And that person is never going to attend that church. And that, for that matter, they're probably never going to attend any church, and they're probably never going to give organized Christianity a chance because they had some jerk that was never discipled that they now associate with the Jesus movement. So you end up being dangerous is the short version. If you are not discipled, you end up being dangerous. The other side of it is Jesus gives a parable about the pearl of great price. So if you're not familiar with it, it goes something like this. There's a man who finds a pearl that is immensely valuable that is for sale. And so he goes and he sells everything that he has so that he can go and buy this pearl. And Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is kind of like that. God's kingdom is like that. It is this immensely, infinitely valuable thing. And if you have to give everything that you have, it is worth it. Just like that pearl is worth more than everything that man in the parable had. You should go and give everything away if it means that you receive the kingdom of heaven. If you cannot view your faith in Jesus the same way, if you're not willing to give all of your time, all of your effort, all of your money, all of your everything to him, like that's, it's a dangerous place for you personally to be in. not just the way you're going to affect those around you, but you're, to steal from another parable, you're putting your hands to the plow and turning your head back. And I'm not convinced from the way that Jesus speaks of such people that God will accept that kind of religion. Like, you need to be sold out. And discipleship is a process of saying, I'm willing to give everything to God. I'm willing to give everything to Jesus. And so I'm going to put all my effort into continually being more and more like him. Like, if you're not willing to take that step, I don't like being the person that says you might be going to hell, but you might be going to hell, or at least you might not be on the trajectory that you need to be on. So why is it important? Because why does it matter? I mean, it is the essence of being a Christian, and you're going to cause so much harm to yourself and others if you're not discipled. It's kind of scary. Or at least it should be.
So I have a quick thing to add to this. I'm sure everybody knows the view that once you're baptized, you're saved, which has prevailed in the church through the 90s and early 2000s, and probably well before that. That is why discipleship is important. Like, that is example A, because you have millions of people running around calling themselves Christians that have no actual tie to Jesus. They are doing nothing to further know him. They're doing nothing to show love to the world around them. They are Christians in title only. And so part of believing in Jesus, I actually just wrote about this for a class that I'm in right now. Part of believing in something is acting on it. And so I always say, I believe in gravity. Gravity is a theory, not a law. It has not been proven anywhere. But I believe in it. So I'm going to live like when something goes up, it's going to come down. That's just the way that it works. So because of that, I'm not going to be jumping off of buildings. I fully admit that if I do, I will fall to the ground and I will be hurt or dead. That's kind of the way it works when gravity works. And so there's certain things that when you believe them, they change the things that you do. They change the way that you live. And your faith in Jesus should be one of those, because Jesus did not say, get them in the water and call them good. Jesus taught through 4 books in your New Testament, you can see Jesus taught the way to live, the proper way to honor God in how you live. And so that's part of why I think it's so important. I just wanted to add that on.
Yeah, and you could point to 100 different passages about what Jesus expects from people and what happens when they fall short of that. And God, of course, is a God of grace, but there's a problem when there's a pattern of behavior where you're always falling short because you're not trying. So when Jesus talks about like people whose behavior causes the little ones to stumble, he says it's better to have a millstone tied around your neck and be thrown into the depths of the ocean. So the implication is the punishment that's coming for you, if you're that kind of person, even if you call yourself a Christian, the punishment that's coming for you is worse than being drowned. But then, I mean, when he's giving the Sermon on the Mount, which we love referencing, there's a reason we love referencing it. And he keeps saying, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are, like, he's talking about people who have been discipled. Like, these are markers of people who are discipled. So if you want to receive, on the other side of things, you want to receive God's blessing, or you want to be the kind of person that God considers blessed, considers to be happy, Makarios, like, you need to be discipled, and you need to cultivate in yourself being poor in spirit and being a peacemaker. And the characteristics that come with a committed, discipled Christian life.
Yeah. So since you already referenced a couple of places, like I did when you asked me, mm-hmm. where do we see discipleship in the Bible? What is, if you had to pick the number one example of what this looks like?
Jesus, the way that Jesus interacts with people. There is, and this is one we haven't gotten into yet that's worth it. If you want more detail on it, read Robert Coleman's Master Plan of Evangelism. Even though he calls it the Master Plan of Evangelism, it's really a book about discipleship. I know that's confusing, but the two are very interrelated. Jesus has different layers of people. So he has like the massive crowds that he teaches when he's giving like the Sermon on the Mount. and there's thousands and thousands of people listening to him. Or there's several examples of that that you can look at where there's huge crowds that Jesus teaches. And then there's a layer below that where there's smaller gatherings who are normally referred to as his disciples. These aren't just the apostles, but these are the apostles plus some other very committed members, like the women that followed them around and supported their ministry because they had wealth to do so. The people that he sent out when he sends out the 72, like these are the kinds of people that we're talking about. Then there's an inner layer inside of that, the 12 apostles who are specifically named in the Gospels. Although most of them, we hear that they're an apostle and then we never hear about them again, which is kind of obnoxious. And then inside of that, there's an even tighter group, which a lot of people will call Jesus's inner circle. And it's James and John, sons of Zebedee, and Peter, who's also called Simon. So there's just three in this inner circle. And so that you see these like concentric circles where on the outside, there are these huge crowds that Jesus teaches, but he doesn't really do much else. He just kind of teaches them. He performs some miracles for them, but that's about it. You have a layer inside of that that gets some special teachings and some more time with Jesus. Then you have the 12 apostles who follow him virtually everywhere. And then you have the inner circle that have very unique, special experiences. They go further into the garden with him. They go up on the Mount of Transfiguration and they actually see his face shine and they see Moses and Elijah show up on the Mount of Transfiguration. So I would take Jesus as like the premium model, go figure, of discipleship, of what discipleship looks like, that there's different layers. There's people you have passing connection to, and then there's people that you will really closely, deeply disciple that will be a part of your life for years and years and go where you go and sleep where you sleep, metaphorically or even sometimes literally. And also, I mean, for us, Jesus, of course, is the perfect discipler, being God and man. But for us, we may be in relationships where the discipleship is somewhat two-way, where we are learning from them, but they are learning from us. That should not be the only kind of discipleship you have. You should have people that are just older and wiser than you. But sometimes you have peers where you're learning and growing together. And so I have like Martin, who we have been very close for years, and we learn from and disciple and challenge one another. And I have Brandy, who's currently working as a youth minister at the church that I'm serving at and is actually living on the same property as me and my wife. We have two separate buildings. We renovated one for her to live in. And so we are literally like living in this little pastor commune where we're all in the same place. And we are learning and growing and discipling one another. So, yeah, I would look at Jesus as the example. It doesn't always look exactly like that, but it's a good way to stratify what discipleship looks like.
Yeah. And honestly, there are a lot of right ways to do discipleship. There are also a lot of wrong ways. And so when you hear me talk about discipleship, I will never talk about it as a science because sometimes things just don't work. And so I like to refer to it as an art. You modify, you change, you create. And what works with one person might not work with the next. And so... for our last question here, Jason, is there anything else that you feel like is really important to add right about here? What are some good ways to do this or some really bad ways to do this, if you have any in mind?
Yeah. So obviously there's tons of things that could be said here, but I'll just say one, which I bring up all the time in these episodes and my preaching and one-on-one conversations. Commit yourself and teach anyone that you are discipling to commit themselves to spiritual disciplines. So if you don't know what spiritual disciplines are, they're things like fasting, solitude, silence, prayer, meditation on scripture, study of scripture. If you have no sort of experience with that, then, or maybe you read your Bible and you pray, but you don't know about all that other stuff, pick up. It's a little thick. The book's a little thick, but it's worth the read. Pick up Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster. It does a great job breaking down each chapter is a different discipline, and it explains the importance of that discipline, how to practice it. It's very practical. It's super easy to read. So even though it's long, you can do like one chapter a month for like a year and a half. and it's super easy to process. But those spiritual disciplines are things that Christians have done for centuries when they're discipling one another, because those practices have a way of changing your inner life in a very unique way. So there's a lot of sins that we fall into because we just don't think, especially sins of like anger and passion. We just don't think. And so we just snap and do the thing that we shouldn't do. You know, we curse at someone or yell at someone or get into an argument that we shouldn't get into, or we lust after someone, or we fall into, teenage boys and pornography. Often, if you're raised in the church, you know you shouldn't be doing those sorts of things, but it's easy to fall into because it's this sort of like thing of passion. So what the spiritual disciplines do is they change your inner life so that it's harder for those things to get through. And those are things you don't just like change by effort, but you actually have to have forming practices that transform your heart and your mind to resist those things, to resist those sins of passion subconsciously. You have to prepare yourself ahead of time. You have to have kind of a spiritual muscle memory. And that's what spiritual disciplines do. It's not the only thing they do, but it's one of the primary things that they do. So I'd say if I was going to give any advice, it's work spiritual disciplines into your discipleship process.
I would also add in, there's another book whose title escapes me currently. But I think it's something like Spiritual Disciplines for the Christian Life. It was written by Dr. Donald Whitney. He is a professor of spiritual formation at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. And he's at Southern Baptist now. But he is an extremely intelligent guy. The stuff that he writes is amazing and has had a huge role in forming not only my life, but a lot of other people's as well. And so he writes a couple of different books on kind of the topic of spiritual formation. And so he's got the one, The Christian Disciplines. He has another one that he calls 10 Questions to Diagnose Your Spiritual Health.
Which is sitting right across from me on a desk in this room. It is a terrific book to figure out. If you ask those 10 questions of yourself, it's a great way to figure out, am I actually progressing or not?
Exactly. And it's good. It's something you can go through, every year, every couple of years, and just kind of assess where you're at. And so
you can write the 10 questions on a piece of paper and hang it on the wall in your office or something, or in your bathroom.
Yeah.
And so just ask those questions periodically.
Yeah. So there's some really good ways to do that. Jason, do you have anything you want to add before we leave?
No, man. I think that's, there's a lot more to add, but I think those are later episodes. So I think I'll call it for today.
Okay. So we want to take a second and thank you guys for listening. We recognize we are not the most interesting people to listen to, and so we appreciate everyone who does. And if you want to help us out, you can always send us $5 in the mail or give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.
So yeah, whichever one's easier.
Exactly. Whichever one. You feel led to do. And so thank you guys so much. And we'll have you guys here next week.
We'll talk, have you guys. Yeah, bye.
We don't really talk guys. To them. We don't really talk to them. And so I was like, we'll talk to you guys next week. And then I was like, we don't really do that.